it's John Dennis on Friday the 25th of September. Today in Pittsburgh, G20 leaders discuss ways of regulating the banks and preventing another global financial crisis. It's Friday, so that means we've got two guests today in our Westminster office. It's the man who's been reporting from the Lib Dems conference in Bournemouth this week, The Guardian's political commentator Michael White.
Hello.
And here in the studio at The Guardian's HQ, our head of business Dan Roberts.
Hello.
Also in today's programme, the hidden victims of war, why there are twice as many former service personnel with criminal records as there are British soldiers in Afghanistan.
And the sobering truth of the morning, like, it's like, what am I doing? I'm not an idiot, you know, it's and I'm behaving like one, I'm getting done for stupid things, and it's, no.
And shining a light into the Dark Ages, the largest hoard of Anglo-Saxon gold ever discovered is unearthed in a field in Staffordshire by a bloke with a metal detector.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
Now, today we're not going to hear a news bulletin, which is what you'd normally listen to at this point in the programme. Instead, we're going to go straight to our panellists, Michael White and Dan Roberts. Today, G20 leaders meeting in Pittsburgh. On the agenda, reforming the banks, tightening the rules on tax havens, stricter rules for hedge funds, and reform of international financial institutions. Dan Roberts, in April at the G20 summit in London, the world leaders went some way to cracking down on tax havens. How much further do you expect them to go today?
Well, it's not looking so great, actually. And the trouble was that back in April, we were in the middle of this almighty crisis, and nothing brings people together like a crisis. And this time round, there's still a sense that things need to be done to clean up the system, but everybody's got their own ideas. And the Americans want to tackle trade imbalances, the French want to tackle bonuses, the Germans want to have more bank regulation, and Gordon Brown just wants a quiet life by the looks of things, and he just wants to get the economy back on the road. And all of these people are pulling in different directions, so we could be surprised, but it's not looking great.
Michael White, do you think that this is another chance for Gordon Brown to shine?
Well, it doesn't seem to do him much good even when he does. Last autumn, I seem to remember, everybody agreed that he took the bull by the horns when at a time when the international community wasn't sure quite what to do in fiscal stimulus and other measures. And he even got a pat on the back from the Nobel laureate, Paul Krugman, the Nobel laureate. This week in New York, he got a prize for being a great statesman. Voters at home are not very impressed, even though his performance in the recession has been, you know, average to good. In fact, more good than average. But as Dan says, once the pressure of the immediate crisis comes off, people tend to drift their own way. That said, you know, the international community has, broadly speaking, moved in the right direction, and with a degree of coordination this time, certainly compared with 1931, which is the benchmark which frightens them all to death when we drifted off into world depression, which was avoidable. They've even made some progress on tax havens. Treasury seems to think it'll get about £1 billion out of the deal with Liechtenstein alone, and Switzerland has become suddenly more obliging. Guardian ought to get at least one round of applause for that, for its campaign earlier this year. Technical matters, capital requirements laid upon banks, bonuses, bit of a distraction, all the big boys tell me. And again, Dan may know the answer. Where are we going on the separation of retail banking from the casino investment variety? Is that an issue at the G20? I should know.
It's dead as a dodo, really. I mean, I think the French would like to make it an issue again, but it's been comprehensively squashed on by Wall Street in the city.
Alistair Darling didn't like it either. I've never quite understood why.
And the European nations want a cap on bankers' pay, and Sarkozy's once again threatened to walk out unless he gets agreement on this.
Yes, the famous Sarkozy flounce. It kind of worked last time in that it did actually concentrate minds, and no one wanted to appear to be going soft on bankers back in April. I think there will be those accusations bandied around again this week, but it doesn't quite have the same sort of toxicity it did back then.
I seem to remember Sarkozy's last performance on the subject. Quite a lot of the things which he proposed were already in hands with a number of the Western governments. Indeed, some have been practiced in the United States, so possibly not France, for many years. It's a bit like a Vince Cable speech, as I've been listening to several this week. When you look at the small print, you find, you know, the Treasury's already on the case and the money's already been taken into calculations when doing the sums. But Sarkozy's got his domestic audience, and that's an important audience for all politicians, even for Gordon Brown, even though he's running up a down escalator in political terms.
And have the banks got anything at all to be worried about, Dan?
They have. I mean, the big issue, as Mike said, is capital ratios, which sounds very dull, but it's basically how much banks have to put away for the rainy day and to make sure they don't go bust next time round. And there's agreement all round that they need to be tightened up. How much they need to be tightened up, I think, is going to fall victim to this slightly diplomatic fudge that we've got going on.
And one of Brown's long-term aims, even before he became Prime Minister, was to beef up some of the international financial institutions. And interesting yesterday, Mike, to see Shriti Vadera, Lady Vadera, who's resigned as business minister. She's going to take on a job at G20.
Yeah, she's one of these people I think the general public doesn't know much about. Used to be a Warburg banker, if I remember rightly, years ago. Became friendly with Gordon Brown, went into government with him as an advisor and later as a minister and a member of the House of Lords, a familiar pattern. Ferocious reputation in Whitehall for sort of shouting at people, but also for getting things done. And she's one of these people who has retained Brown's confidence. So this isn't a brush off. It isn't somebody jumping ship as the ship goes down with all hands. It's a job, so far as I understand it, which Brown has tried to create to help boost to the G20, which doesn't have a proper secretariat, of course. It's a reflection of changing times, the G20. It used to be the G7, then we brought the Russians in for good behaviour, poor boy at the gate. And now it's expanded to take into account economic realities, which are basically the rise of Asia and what they call the BRICS, which includes Brazil as well. And she's obviously going to be some sort of player, both working for the G20, but also a hinge with Britain. So she's a good placing by Brown, and I wouldn't be surprised if the Tories kept her on in some capacity. She's certainly not a fool. She's got a tough reputation.
Assuming, of course, that the Tories win the election, Mike.
Oh, sorry, what did I say? What did I say there?
Dan, I mean, you know, G20 policing of the world's financial markets, that's quite a good thing if that comes off, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, it kind of sounded like a very good sell. You know, Shriti, do you want to go and work for South Korea for a few years, which is effectively what she'll be doing because they're hosting the G20 next year. I agree with Mike to an extent. I mean, I think it could be a very interesting linchpin role. But on the other hand, she hasn't been quite as powerful and effective working for Mandelson in the business department as she was in the Treasury under Brown.
Oh, I wonder why.
I think her slightly abrasive style may have done her even less favours there than it did at the Treasury. So I can't help think that it's a sideways move at best.
Mike, we better talk about this snub that took place on Wednesday, or didn't take place, if you believe Number 10 and the White House. What was actually going on? Why did Number 10, the team at Number 10, manage to sort of pull embarrassment out of what should have been, quite a good week for Brown?
Well, I'm not on the trip, but I've been on trips like it, and the press go and they get into a bubble of excitement, and somewhere somebody got hold of the impression, perhaps loose talk by diplomats, that's often the case, that Brown's people had been trying too hard to set up a one-to-one FaceTime, as they say in this business, with Obama directly. He's seen Obama several times. Obama's under enormous pressure at the UN from people he doesn't see so often. And I suspect a more confident regime, and this is mere speculation on my part, more confident regime than the present tenants of Number 10, and perhaps a bit politically cuter, wouldn't have made an issue of this, and certainly not let it get into us. Sort of page one story, as it was in the Guardian, other papers today. Nick Robinson of the BBC took a call from a top White House man. I imagine that must be the press secretary himself, saying, look, this isn't true. We've not snubbed the man. But the Brits are always neurotic about the wretched special relationship. The Americans sort of love us, but, you know, we're like a Muslim prince's first wife. We've been around a long time. He's still quite fond of us, but there are other girls he wants to see. And the first wife, if she's smart, just knows how to play it. And she's nice to the other girls and maintains her influence through different means from those she used many years ago. There is a special relationship and it shows up under pressure, but we worry far too much about it and the Americans don't worry much about it at all.
I couldn't agree more. I don't think it's not just an unconfident prime minister that it shames. It's an unconfident country. I mean, the idea that we make a fuss about these things, I just think it makes us look appalling to the outside world. I mean, just it's so crazy.
The outside world's not watching.
No, they don't really care either.
No.
I'm John Dennis. You'll hear more from my guests, Michael White and Dan Roberts, in a few minutes. But now, let's hear about another story that The Guardian's reporting on today. It's about the plight of former servicemen and women and their families after they return to civilian life. The National Association of Probation Officers, NAPO, has produced some research showing that thousands of former soldiers have got criminal records. The Guardian heard from one ex-serviceman who was jailed within a year of leaving the forces for 4.5 years. He lost control of a car, resulting in a crash that killed another driver.
I mean, at the time when I went to prison, I was really low. I couldn't have got much lower. I would have gone back into the army because I was realising that there was nothing for me on the outside. Unfortunately, because of what happened, I wasn't allowed to join the forces again. So it pretty much cut my choices down and I ended up in a rut. And it basically was a rut. And just going from one thing from the other, I had problems holding jobs down, and it's just been a nightmare, an absolute nightmare. Unfortunately, I am turning a corner now at the moment, and I can see that, and everybody else can see it too, and it's
your
good.
Friends and family.
Yeah, and they've stood by me all the way through it, and they look at me sometimes, and they just think, what an idiot, why are you doing that? And you know, when in the sobering truth of the morning, like, it's like, what am I doing? I'm not an idiot, you know, it's and I'm behaving like one, I'm getting done for stupid things, and it's, no. But it just seems to be like a roller coaster. I'll be great for a couple of months and things will go well. And then when they start going wrong, they really, really do start going wrong.
With details of the probation union's report, our Home Affairs editor, Alan Travis.
They estimate that there are about 20,000 veterans of the armed forces who've served over the years in anything from Northern Ireland, Iraq to Afghanistan, who have been convicted of crimes and are currently either in prison, on probation or on parole. They did a survey, NAPO, the Probation Union, about 12 months ago of those in prison and came up with an estimate of about 8,500. People currently in prison came from an armed service, former service background, particularly active service, and now they've extended that to those under probation as well. And they've come up with this figure of 20,000, which is probably double the number of currently serving armed forces personnel in Afghanistan.
Do they know the reason for this?
Well, they've looked at detailed case studies of about 90 files forwarded by different probation staff around the country. And the most common sort of background factors are chronic alcohol abuse or drug misuse arising from a majority of cases, either post-traumatic stress disorder or depression. And the most common offence committed by them is domestic violence. So it's kind of a very grim toll, kind of a hidden cost of war, hidden victims of war. Women in this country who are suffering as a hands of being assaulted by ex-partners who happen to be ex-servicemen who've seen some horrific experiences during their time serving in the army.
What kind of welfare provision is there for servicemen and women leaving the armed forces?
Well, the Ministry of Defence does try to provide. There's several welfare organisations and counselling, psychiatric help, combat stress is one organisation that tries to help. But what the Probation Union is saying is that the criminal justice system hasn't really recognised this is a problem, and they're not being identified when they're on arrest or conviction by the police or the courts or the probation service and referred to these various MOD welfare programmes.
Alan Travis, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/military. I'm with Dan Roberts and in our Westminster office, Michael White. Mike, stories like this can only have a negative effect on the way the public view the Afghan war. How much nervousness is there in the government about the decline in voters' support for Britain's military presence in Afghanistan?
Well, it's happening in the United States as well, and nobody was very keen on it in Europe, and they don't send their troops out after dark, which is why so few of them have been casualties, as the British Canadians and Americans, of course, have been. So there's a wobble, a big wobble on it. You know, is it winnable? Is it pointless? Mr. Karzai is so unattractive. The elections were fraudulent. I don't know. I do remember treatment of soldiers and, you know, whether they've been injured or kicked out of the army and ended up in crime, as that report said. Poem of Kipling's 100 years ago, some of the listeners will remember it. The soldiers kicked out of the pubs and kicked out of the street and generally despised. And the recurring line in the poem is, but it's thank you, Mr. Atkins, when the guns begin to shout, the idea that when there's trouble, the soldiers are popular again. But Afghanistan's a long way away from Britain. And our wars are now fought by small professional armies, and except when those corpses come through the military airfields and march through the streets of the West Midlands, then we don't care too much.
Now, Mike, you in your blog on the Guardian's website this week stood by Gordon Brown's decision, or said that he'd made the right decision by standing by Lady Scotland, the Attorney General. She was fined £5,000 for employing an illegal immigrant. Gordon Brown didn't sack her, but one of the parliamentary aides, Stephen Hesford, did resign. Why was Brown right to stand by Lady Scotland?
Well, she behaved badly. She's a law officer of the Crown, married to another barrister, and she didn't check the papers of her housekeeper properly, although it's easy to see why whatever she did see looked okay, because the housekeeper was married to a solicitor. They're all lawyers in this case, except the woman who got sacked. Funny that, isn't it? She was married to a Brit who was a solicitor, and I guess Scotland thought that was enough. Well, it isn't enough, and a lot of people ringing the phone-ins and getting angry on the blogosphere saying, one law for the rich, one law for the poor. I'm not so sure about that. It was an administrative mistake. People were forced to resign from the Clinton administration, and again, I think Obama lost somebody for failures with immigration procedures of this kind. But everybody knows that it happens in all developed countries. People desperate to work here use all sorts of reasons for doing so, often illegal, often wrong. They get amnesties from time to time. When you consider all the issues we've been talking in the programme up to now, we haven't even touched on global warming, for heaven's sake, it seemed to me she deserved the £5,000 fine and no sympathy at all. She was quite tactless about it, compared it with the congestion charge fine, but nonetheless, it's pretty trivial. She's a senior law officer of the Crown. She's a woman. She's a black woman. She's come from a poor background. Good for her. I thought she deserved a second chance. That's all.
I'm not so sure. I mean, I agree that it's not a terribly important crime, but it's one that an awful lot of businesses are having to deal with at the moment. And all across the country, there are HR departments asking their employers all to bring their passports in at the moment so that everybody has to be checked. In some companies, that's being done across the board so as not to look discriminatory. But I'm sure there are some companies where it's just the brown faces that are being asked to bring in their passports, and people are feeling this in a very kind of discriminatory way. And all the time, people are worried about if they do break the law, what happens to them. So I think to see a government minister let off the hook in this way sends quite a bad signal. Either the law matters or it doesn't.
Well, the law is often, law is passed in this country by governments of both parties, which is very difficult to enforce. They pass it to appease the Daily Mail, because the Daily Mail makes a fuss about immigration in one form or another and illegals and all the usual stuff. And then it's the Daily Mail who's driving this story about Lady Scotland and many other stories indeed. I was at a seminar yesterday when somebody said party conferences suffer Daily Mail. Mailization. They're less interesting because political parties are afraid to discuss controversies like drug reform, which might offend the sensibilities of the Mail. That's another reason for not sacking the woman.
But that's a reason for not having the law. I mean, I agree. I don't think that. I think it's a badly drafted piece of legislation.
Yeah, they have it both ways, though, don't they? They just as they complain one day that the nanny state is getting into all our lives, the next day some paedophile runs amok and they demand these ridiculous laws which are coming in now, whereby everybody who deals with a scout group or reads to schools will have to be vetted for child molestation. Similar sort of episode. They have it both ways, and I wish a government of any party would stand up to them one day.
Dan, there's probably another story that I imagine the Daily Mail will be covering in some shape or form is about Waitrose. It's unveiled plans for a new network of convenience stores. These are sort of similar to the Marks and Spencers local stores that we've seen. And they're going to be also selling Waitrose branded food in hundreds of branches of Boots. What's going on here?
Well, another one of those surprise beneficiaries of the recession, actually. You'd have thought the Waitrose would be the first to feel the pinch. And there's two schools of thought. One is that, to paraphrase the politicians, we're all middle class now, and it's the sort of the great sort of spread of desire for better food, for healthier food, and it's benefiting the type of retailers that do that sort of thing, and that people who can afford it are putting a higher value on Waitrose food. The other school of thought is that Waitrose has just learned to play the discounters at their own game, and it's actually been introducing value ranges like the Aldis and the Lidls, and that it's actually become more affordable as a result. I think it's a little bit of both, but it's an interesting sign of how society's attitudes to food and how much we'll spend on food are changing.
And Mike, Labour conference next week. Does Labour still hope that if the economy recovers sufficiently, people will vote for them at the next election?
I don't think many people think they can win anymore in their darker moments. There are always a few sort of kamikaze optimists in any political party, so there should be nothing wrong with optimism. But the facts are against them pretty heavily. I think the debate is really not really about replacing Gordon Brown. There's no evidence that I can spot that anybody's serious about it. Charles Clarke has become a counterproductive figure. But the idea that they might get enough bounce of a recovering economy to avoid disastrous defeat, a wipeout of a 1983 scale. This is important for the future because the more seats they lose, then they get pushed back into their heartland, and hardcore MPs who, like the guns of Singapore in 1941, were facing the wrong way. They're facing to the past. What we need is more socialism and more state and all the things which, you know, haven't worked in the past and won't work in the future, despite the fact that the free market banks produced such a train crash in the last 2 years.
Well, Dan, you're off to Brighton next week with Mike and the rest of the Guardian team. Are you looking forward to it?
Yeah, I think it's always fascinating for me as a business and economics journalist to sort of see those two subjects take centre stage politically. And I think this year more than ever, conference season is going to be dominated by discussion about public finances, public spending. And most importantly, the backdrop, which nobody really knows, is the economy going to turn around in time to save Brown? And so I'm very much looking forward to it.
And Mike, you've been to more of these events than probably you care to remember, but do you still look forward to them?
I don't look forward to them, but I enjoy them when I'm there, is the answer I always give to people. It's an appalling backdrop, the public finances. You could weep. But the more you've been to these things and the more you've seen it all before, where I could remember back to the 70s. I don't know why I'm laughing. We didn't laugh then.
Well, Mike, we look forward to hearing from you next week. Thank you both very much for joining us today. Now, archaeology and a historic discovery in a field in Staffordshire. More than 1,500 pieces of Anglo-Saxon treasure dating from between AD 650 and 750 have been found by Terry Herbert, a metal detector enthusiast. And they're thought to be so significant that they could radically alter our understanding of the period. All of the pieces discovered so far have been brought to Birmingham City Museum, from where The Guardian's Maeve Kennedy reports.
Are really fantastic, but they are almost all damaged, and this is obviously part of the story. These were things that were originally attached to swords, parts of fantastic helmets, possibly decorations on books, on saddles, on bits of horse harness, and they've all been ripped off the pieces they were originally attached to. There are various explanations for this. One is that the most precious pieces of the objects were being collected as a kind of ritual offering to the gods. The other, which I must say I find more persuasive, is that this is a load of swag. This is the fruits of a massive raiding party by the Mercians, who were famously ferocious kingdom on some of their neighbours, and that there might have been kings and princes in East Anglia or Northumberland or Kent who were ruining the loss of their treasures that have now ended up in this hoard.
The scale of this treasure, I mean, there are thought to be up to 1,500 items. It's astonished experts, hasn't it?
More. I mean, this hoard is just full superlatives. There are, at the moment, there are 1,500 pieces, 5 kilos of gold, 2.5 kilos of silver. But there are large blocks of soil just in the thick, heavy, wet clay that came out of the ground. And you can see little pieces of gold glinting in them. There are hundreds more pieces of gold still trapped in those soil blocks, and it could be months or even years before the full total of what's been found in this hoard emerges.
And it was discovered by an amateur with a metal detector.
Yes, it's a very sensitive issue in archaeology, amateurs going out into cloudlands and finding archaeology. This guy has been working with the Portable Antiquities Scheme, which encourages amateurs to report everything they find. And of course, most of what they find is bits and bobs, you know, bits of broken metal, scruffy old coins. Every now and then, they do literally find treasure. This guy's been reporting everything he found for years. The best thing he found for this was a little piece of Iron Age horse harness, which he was thrilled at. This time, he did literally strike gold. By law, you have to report gold. It's treasure, and it's the property of the crown. But because there's already a well-established system for reporting these finds, he went straight to an archaeologist he knew who called him the expert. And this field has been gone through literally like a scene of crime, a fingertip search to get every scrap of evidence out of it. And of course, that process has left many more mysteries. There is no tomb, there is no burial pit, there is no building, there is no road, there is nothing except a green grass field was sown all over with pieces of gold.
Maeve Kennedy. And the producer of today's show was Phil Maynard. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.